cackle was dying away, and I would soon be gone from Ignix. The cackle was dying away, but it insisted on having the last laugh. Many years later, at the end of my life, the mocking elements of Ignix would return to haunt me. But this was, 223.M41, and I was only just out on my own. That was Regia Occulta, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. Missing in Action, by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. I lost my left hand on Sameter. This is how it occurred. On the 13th day of Sagittar, local calendar, 3 days before the solstice, in the mid-rise district of the city of Urbitane, an itinerant evangelist called Laszlo Mombril was found shuffling aimlessly around the flat roof of a disused tannery, lacking his eyes, his tongue, his nose, and both of his hands. Urbitane is the second city of Sameter, a declining agrochemical planet in the Helican subsector, and it is no stranger to crimes of cruelty and spite brought on by the vicissitudes of neglect and social deprivation afflicting its tightly packed population. But this act of barbarity stood out for 2 reasons. First, it was no hot-blooded assault or alcohol-fueled manslaughter, but a deliberate and systematic act of brutal, almost ritual mutilation. Second, it was the 4th such crime discovered that month. I had been on Sameter for just 3 weeks, investigating the links between a bonded trade federation and a secessionist movement on Hesperus at the request of Lord Inquisitor Rorkan. The links proved to be nothing. Urbitane's economic slough had forced the Federation to chase unwise business with unscrupulous shipmasters, and the real meat of the case lay on Hesperus. But I believe this was the Lord Inquisitor's way of gently easing me back into active duties following the long and arduous affair of the Necrotuke. By the Imperial calendar, it was 241.M41, late in that year. I had just finished several self-imposed months of recuperation, meditation, and study on Thracian Primaris. The eyes of the demon host Cherubael still woke me some nights, and I wore permanent scars from torture at the hands of the sadist, Gorgon Locke. His Strucine neural scourge had damaged my nervous system and paralyzed my face. I would not smile again for the rest of my life. But the battle wounds sustained on KCX 1288 and 56 Izar had healed, and I was now itching to renew my work. This idle task on Sameter had suited me, so I had taken it and closed the dossier after a swift and efficient investigation. But latterly, as I prepared to leave, officials of the Munitorum unexpectedly requested an audience. I was staying with my associates in a suite of rooms in the Urbitane Excelsior, a shabby but well-appointed establishment in the high-rise district of the city. Through soot-stained, armoured roundels of glass 20 meters across, the suite looked out across the filthy grey towers of the city to the brackish waters of the polluted bay 20 kilometers away. Ornithopters and biplanes buzzed between the massive city structures, and the running lights of freighters and orbitals glowed in the smog as they swung down towards the landing port. Out on the isthmus, through a haze of yellow, stagnant air, Promethean refineries belched brown smoke into the perpetual twilight. "They're here," said Beckwin, entering the suite's lounge from the outer lobby. She had dressed in a demure gown of blue damask and a silk pashmina, perfectly in keeping with my instruction that we should present a muted but powerful image. I myself was clad in a suit of soft black linen, with a waistcoat of grey velvet and a hip-length black leather stormcoat.
"Do you need me for this?"
asked Midas Betancourt, my pilot and confidant. I shook my head. "I don't intend to be delayed here. I just have to be polite. Go on to the landing port and make sure the gun cutter's readied for departure." He nodded and left. Beckwin showed the visitors in. I had felt it necessary to be polite, because Eskeen Hansard, Urbitane's Minister of Security, had come to see me himself. He was a massive man in a double-breasted brown tunic, his big frame offset oddly by his finely featured, boyish face. He was escorted by 2 bodyguards in grey, armour-ribbed uniforms, and a short but handsome black-haired woman in a dark blue body glove. I had made sure I was sitting in an armchair when Beckwin showed them in, so I could rise in a measured, respectful way. I wanted them to be in no doubt who was really in charge here. "Minister Hansard," I said, shaking his hand. "I am Inquisitor Gregor Eisenhorn of the Ordo Xenos. These are my associates, Elizabeth Beckwin, Arbites Chastener Godwin Fischig, and Savant Uber Amos. How may I help you?"
"I have no wish to waste your time, Inquisitor," he said, apparently nervous in my presence.
That was good, just as I had intended it.
"A case has been brought to my attention that I believe is beyond the immediate purview of the city Arbites. Frankly, it smacks of warp corruption, and cries out for the attention of the Inquisition."
He was direct. That impressed me. A ranking official of the Imperium, anxious to be seen to be doing the right thing. Nevertheless, I still expected his business might be a mere nothing, like the affair of the Trade Federation, a local crime requiring only my nod of approval that it was fine for him to continue in clothes. Men like Hansard are often over-careful, in my experience.
"There have been 4 deaths in the city during the last month that we believe to be linked. I would appreciate your advice on them. They are connected by merit of the ritual mutilation involved."
"Show me," I said.
"Captain," he responded.
Arbites Captain Hurley Rex was the handsome woman with the short black hair. She stepped forward, nodded respectfully, and gave me a data slate with the gold crest of the Adeptus Arbites on it.
"I have prepared a digested summary of the facts," she said.
I began to speed-read the slate, already preparing the gentle knockback I was expecting to give to his case. Then I stopped, slowed, read back. I felt a curious mix of elation and frustration. Even from this cursorial glance, there was no doubt this case required the immediate attention of the Imperial Inquisition. I could feel my instincts stiffen and my appetites whetten for the first time in months. In bothering me with this, Minister Hansard was not being over-careful at all. At the same time, my heart sank with the realization that my departure from this miserable city would be delayed. All 4 victims had been blinded and had their noses, tongues, and hands removed, at the very least. The evangelist, Mombril, had been the only one found alive. He had died from his injuries 8 minutes after arriving at Urbitane Midrise Sector Infirmary. It seemed to me likely that he had escaped his ritual tormentors somehow before they could finish their work. The other 3 were a different story. Paul Graven, a machinesmith. Luthar Hewal, a rugmaker. Idilane Faspel, a midwife. Hewal had been found a week before by city sanitation servitors during routine maintenance to a soil stack in the Midrise district. Someone had attempted to burn his remains and then flush them into the city's ancient waste system, but the human body is remarkably durable. The post could not prove his missing body parts had not simply succumbed to decay and been flushed away, but the damage to the ends of the forearm bones seemed to speak convincingly of a saw or chain blade. When Idilane Faspel's body was recovered from a crawl space under the roof of a mid-rise tenement hab, it threw more light on the extent of Hewal's injuries. Not only had Faspel been mutilated in the manner of the evangelist Mombril, but her brain, brainstem, and heart had been excised. The injuries were hideous. One of the roof workers who discovered her had subsequently committed suicide. Her bloodless, almost desiccated body, dried out, smoked, if you will, by the tenement's heating vents, had been wrapped in a dark green cloth similar to the material of an Imperial Guard issue bedroll, and stapled to the underside of the rafters with an industrial nail gun. Cross-reference between her and Hewal convinced the Arbites that the rugmaker had very probably suffered the removal of his brainstem and heart too. Until that point, they had ascribed the identifiable lack of those soft organs to the almost toxic levels of organic decay in the liquescent filth of the soil stack. Graven, actually the first victim found, had been dredged from the waters of the bay by salvage ship. He had been presumed to be a suicide dismembered by the screws of a passing boat, until Rex's careful cross-checking had flagged up too many points of similarity. Because of the peculiar circumstances of their various post-mortem locations, it was pathologically impossible to determine any exact date or time of death. But Rex could be certain of a window. Graven had been last seen on the 19th of Aquiare, 3 days before his body had been dredged up. Hiwal had delivered a finished rug to a high-rise customer on the 24th, and had dined that same evening with friends at a charcoot in Midrise. Faspal had failed to report for work on the 5th of Sagittar, although the night before she had seemed happy and looking forward to her next shift, according to friends.
"I thought at first we might have a serial predator loose in Midrise," said Rex. "But the pattern of mutilation seems to me more extreme than that. This is not feral murder, or even psychopathic, post-slaying depravity. This is specific, purposeful ritual."
"How do you arrive at that?" asked my colleague, Fischig. Fischig was a senior Arbetes from Hubris, with plenty of experience in murder cases. Indeed, it was his fluency with procedure and familiarity with modus operandi that had convinced me to make him a part of my band, that and his ferocious strength in a fight. Rex looked sidelong at him, as if he was questioning her ability.
"Because of the nature of the dismemberment, because of the way the remains were disposed of."
She looked at me.
"In my experience, Inquisitor, a serial killer secretly wants to be found, and certainly wants to be known. It will display its kills with wanton openness, declaring its power over the community. It thrives on the terror and fear it generates. Great efforts were made to hide these bodies. That suggests to me the killer was far more interested in the deaths themselves than in the reaction to the deaths."
"Well put, Captain," I said. "That has been my experience, too. Cult killings are often hidden so that the cult can continue its work without fear of discovery."
"Suggesting that there are other victims still to find,"
said Beckwin casually, a chilling prophecy, as it now seems to me.
"Cult killings," said the minister. "I brought this to your attention because I feared as much. But do you really think—"
"On Alphex, the warp cult removed their victims' hands and tongues because they were organs of communication," Amos began. "On Bretaria, the brains were scooped out in order for the cult to ingest the spiritual matter, the anima, as you might say, of their prey. A number of other worlds have suffered cult predations where the eyes have been forfeit. Gullinglass, Pentari, Hesperus, Messina, windows of the soul, you see. The heretics of Saint Scarif, in fact, severed their ritual victims' hands and then made them write out their last confessions using ink quills rammed into the stumps of—"
"Enough information, Amos," I said. The minister was looking pale. "These are clearly cult killings, sir," I said. "There is a noxious cell of chaos at liberty in your city, and I will find it." I went at once to the Midrise district. Grievan, Hiwal, and Faspal had all been residents of that part of Urbitane, and Mombril, though a visitor to the metropolis, had been found there too. Amos went to the Munitorum record spire in Highrise to search the local archives. I was particularly interested in historical cult activity on Sameter, and on date significance. Fischig, Beckwin, and Rex accompanied me. The genus loci of a place can often say much about the crimes committed therein. So far, my stay on Sameter had only introduced me to the cleaner, high-altitude regions of Urbitane's high-rise, up above the smog cover. Midrise was a dismal, wretched place of neglect and poverty. A tarry resin of pollution coated every surface, and acid rain poured down unremittingly. Raw-engined traffic crawled nose to tail down the poorly lit streets, and the very stone of the buildings seemed to be rotting. The smoggy darkness of Midrise had a red, firelit quality, the backwash of the flares from giant gas processors. It reminded me of picture-slate engravings of the Inferno. We stepped from Rex's armored speeder at the corner of Shearing Street and Pentecost. The captain pulled on her Arbetes helmet and a quilted flak coat. I began to wish for a hat of my own or a rebreather mask. The rain stank like urine. Every 30 seconds or so, an express flashed past on the elevated trackway, shaking the street.
"In here," Rex called, and led us through a shutter off the thoroughfare into the dank hallway of a tenement hab.
Everything was stained with centuries of grime. The heating had been set too high, perhaps to combat the murky wetness outside, but the result was simply an overwhelming humidity and a smell like the fur of a mangy canine. This was Idilane Faspel's last resting place. She'd been found in the roof.
Where did she live?
Asked Fischig. 2 streets away. She had a parlour on one of the old court habs.
He well?
His hab about 1 kilometre west. His remains were found 5 blocks east.
I looked at the data slate. The tannery where Mombril had been found was less than 30 minutes' walk from here, and Graven's home a short tram ride. The only thing that broke the geographical focus of these lives and deaths was the fact that Graven had been dumped in the bay.
It hasn't escaped my notice that they all inhabited a remarkably specific area, Rex smiled.
I never thought it had, but remarkably is the word. It isn't just the same quarter or district. It's an intensely close network of streets. A neighborhood.
Suggesting? Asked Beckwin.
The killer or killers are local too, said Fischig.
Or someone from elsewhere has a particular hatred of this neighborhood and comes into it to do his or her killing, said Rex.
Like a hunting ground,
noted Fischig.
I nodded. Both possibilities had merit. Look around, I told Fischig and Beckwin, well aware that Rex's officers had already been all over the building. But she said nothing. Our expert appraisal might turn up something different. I found a small office at the end of the entrance hall. It was clearly the cubbyhole of the habitat superintendent. Sheaves of paper were pinned to the flakboard wall. Rental dockets, maintenance rosters, notes of resident complaints. There was a box tray of lost property, a partially disassembled mini-servitor in a tub of oil, a stale stink of cheap liquor. A faded ribbon and paper rosette from an imperial shrine was pinned over the door with a regimental rank stud. What are you doing in here? I looked round. The superintendent was a middle-aged man in a dirty overall suit.
Details. I always look for details.
The gold signet ring with the wheat ear symbol. The row of permanent metal sutures, closing the scar on his scalp where the hair had never grown back. The prematurely weathered skin. The guarded look in his eyes. I told him who I was, and he didn't seem impressed. Then I asked him who he was, and he said, The super. What are you doing in here? I used my will, sparingly. The psychic gift sometimes closes as many doors as it opens, but there was something about this man. He needed a jolt. What is your name? I asked, modulating my voice to carry the full weight of the psychic probe. He rocked backwards, and his pupils dilated in surprise. Quater Traves, he mumbled. Did you know the midwife Fasful? A sinner around?
To speak to? He shook his head. His eyes never left mine.
Did she have friends? He shrugged. What about strangers? Anyone been hanging around the hab? His eyes narrowed. A sullen, mocking look, as if I hadn't seen the streets outside. Who has access to the roof space where her body was found?
Ain't nobody been up there. Not since the place been built. Then the heating packs in, and the contractors has to break through the roof to get up there. They found her.
There isn't a hatch.
Shutter. Locked, and no one has a key. Easier to go through the plasterboard.
Outside, we sheltered from the rain under the elevated railway.
That's what Traves told me, too, Rex confirmed. No one had been into the roof for years until the contractors broke their way in.
Someone had. Someone with the keys to the shutter. The killer. The soil stack where Hewell had been found was behind a row of commercial properties built into an ancient skin of scaffolding that cased the outside of a toolfitter's workshop like a cobweb. There was what seemed to be a bar 2 stages up, where a neon sign flicked between an imperial aquila and a fleur-de-lis. Fischig and Rex continued up to the next scaffolding level to peer in through the stained windows of the habs there. Beckwin and I went into the bar. The light was grey inside. At a high bar, 4 or 5 drinkers sat on ratchet stools and ignored us. The scent of obscura smoke was in the air. There was a woman behind the counter who took exception to us from the moment we came in. She was in her 40s, with a powerful, almost masculine build. Her vest was cut off at the armpits, and her arms were as muscular as Fischig's. There was the small tattoo of a skull and crossbones on her bicep. The skin of her face was weathered and coarse.
Help you? She asked.
wiping the counter with a glass cloth. As she did so, I saw that her right arm, from the elbow down, was a prosthetic.
"Information," I said.
She flicked her cloth at the row of bottles on the shelves behind her.
"Not a brand I know."
"You know a man called Hewell?"
"No."
"The guy they found in the waste pipes behind here."
"Oh. Didn't know he had a name."
Now I was closer, I could see the tattoo on her arm wasn't a skull and crossbones. It was a wheat ear. "We all have names. What's yours?"
"I'm in Lund."
"You live around here?"
"Live is too strong a word."
She turned away to serve someone else.
"Scary bitch," said Beckwin, as we went outside. "Everyone acts like they've got something to hide."
"Everyone does, even if it's simply how much they hate this town." The heart had gone out of Urbitain, out of Sameter itself, about 70 years before. The mill hives of Thracian Primaris eclipsed Sameter's production, and export profits fell away. In an effort to compete, the authorities freed the refineries to escalate production by stripping away the legal restrictions on atmospheric pollution levels. For hundreds of years, Urbitain had had problems controlling its smog and air pollutants. For the last few decades, it hadn't bothered any more. My Vox earplug chimed. It was Amos. "What have you found?"
"It's most perturbatory. Sameter has been clear of taint for a goodly while. The last inquisitorial investigation was 31 years ago standard, and that wasn't here in Urbitain, but in Aquitaine, the capital. A rogue psyker. The planet has its fair share of criminal activity, usually narcotics trafficking and the consequential mob fighting, but nothing really markedly heretical."
"Nothing with similarities to the ritual methods?"
"No, and I've gone back 2 centuries.
"What about the dates?"
"Sagittar 13th is just shy of the solstice, but I can't make any meaning out of that. The purge of the Sarpetal Hives is usually commemorated by upswings of cult activity in the subsector, but that's 6 weeks away. The only other thing I can find is that this Sagittar 5th was the 21st anniversary of the Battle of Clodeshi Heights."
"I don't know it."
"The 6th of 7 full-scale engagements during the 16-month Imperial campaign on Surialis 6.
"Surialis? That's in the next damn subsector. Amos, every day of the year is the anniversary of any Imperial action somewhere. What connection are you making?"
"The 9th Sameter Infantry saw service in the war on Surialis."
Fishig and Rex had rejoined us from their prowl around the upper stages of the scaffolding. Rex was talking on her own vox set. She signed off and looked at me, rain drizzling off her visor.
"They've found another one, Inquisitor," she said.
It wasn't one. It was 3. And their discovery threw the affair wide open. An old warehouse in the mill zone, 10 streets away from Faspel's Hab, had been damaged by fire 2 months before, and now the municipal work crews had moved in to tear it down and reuse the lot as a site for cheap prefab habitat blocks. They'd found the bodies behind the wall insulation in a mouldering section untouched by the fire. A woman and 2 men, systematically mutilated in the manner of the other victims. But these were much older. I could tell that even at a glance. I crunched across the debris littering the floor space of the warehouse shell. Rain streamed in through the roof holes, illuminated as a blizzard of white specks by the cold blue beams of the Arbites floodlights shining into the place. Arbites officers were all around, but they hadn't touched the discovery itself. Mummified and shriveled, these fetally curled, pitiful husks had been in the wall a long time. "What's that?" I asked. Fishig leaned forward for a closer look.
"Adhesive tape, wrapped around them to hold them against the partition. Old. The gums decayed."
"That pattern on it. The silver flecks.
I think it's military issue stuff. Matte silver coating. You know the sort. The coating's coming off with age."
"These bodies are different ages," I said.
"I thought so too," said Fishig.
We had to wait 6 hours for a preliminary report from the District Examiner Medicae, but it confirmed our guess. All 3 bodies had been in the wall for at least 8 years, and then for different lengths of time. Decompositional anomalies showed that one of the males had been in position for as much as 12 years. The other 2 added subsequently, at different occasions. No identifications had yet been made.
The warehouse was last used 6 years ago, Rex told me. I want a roster of workers employed there before it went out of business. Someone using the same MO and the same spools of adhesive tape had hidden bodies there over a period of years. The disused tannery where poor Mombrel had been found stood at the junction between Xerxes Street and a row of slum tenements known as the Pilings. It was a fetid place, with the stink of the lye and coruscutum used in the tanning process still pungent in the air. No amount of acid rain could wash that smell out. There were no stairs. Fischig, Beckwin, and I climbed up to the roof via a metal fire ladder. How long does a man survive mutilated like that? From the severed wrists alone, he'd bleed out in 20 minutes, perhaps, Fischig estimated. Clearly, if he had made an escape, he'd have the adrenaline of terror sustaining him a little. So, when he was found up here, he can have been no more than 20 minutes from the scene of his brutalization. We looked around. The wretched city looked back at us, close-packed and dense. There were hundreds of possibilities. It might take days to search them all. But we could narrow it down. How did he get on the roof? I asked.
I was wondering that, said Fischig.
The ladder we came up by.
Beckwin trailed off as she realized her gaffe.
Without hands, Fischig smirked.
Or sight, I finished. Perhaps he didn't escape. Perhaps his abusers put him here.
Or perhaps he fell,
Beckwin said, pointing. The back of a tall warehouse overshadowed the tannery to the east. 10 meters up, there were shattered windows.
If he was in there somewhere,
fled blindly, and fell through onto this roof. Well reasoned, Elizabeth, I said. The Arbetes had done decent work, but not even Rex had thought to consider this inconsistency. We went round to the side entrance of the warehouse. The battered metal shutters were locked. A notice pasted to the wall told would-be intruders to stay out of the property of Hundelmass Agricultural Stowage. I took out my multi-key and disengaged the padlock. I saw Fischig had drawn his sidearm. What's the matter?
I had a feeling just then, like we were being watched.
We went inside. The air was cold and still, and smelled of chemicals. Rows of storage vats filled with chemical fertilizers lined the echoing warehall. The second floor was bare-boarded and hadn't been used in years. Wire mesh had been stapled over a doorway to the next floor, and rainwater dripped down. Fischig pulled at the mesh. It was cosmetic only, and folded aside neatly. Now I drew my auto-pistol, too. On the street side of the third floor, which was divided into smaller rooms, we found a chamber 10 meters by 10, on the floor of which was spread a sheet of plastic, smeared with old blood and other organic deposits. There was a stink of fear.
This is where they did him, Fischig said with certainty.
No sign of cult markings or chaos symbology, I mused.
Maybe not, said Beckwin,
crossing the room, being careful not to step on the smeared plastic sheet. For the sake of her shoes, not the crime scene, I was sure.
What's this? Something was hung here.
2 rusty hooks in the wall, scraped enough to show something had been hanging there recently. On the floor below was a curious cross drawn in yellow chalk. I've seen that before somewhere, I said. My vox bleeped.
It was Rex. I've got that worker, Rusty, you asked for.
Good. Where are you?
Coming to find you at the tannery, if you're still there.
We'll meet you on the corner of Xerxes Street. Tell your staff we have a crime scene here in the agricultural warehouse. We walked out of the killing room towards the stairwell. Fischig froze and brought up his gun.
Again?
I whispered. He nodded and pushed Beckwin into the cover of a door jamb. Silence, apart from the rain and the scurry of vermin. Gun braced, Fischig looked up at the derelict roof. It may have been my imagination, but it seemed as if a shadow had moved across the bare rafters. I moved forward, scanning the shadows with my pistol. Something creaked. A floorboard. Fischig pointed to the stairs. I nodded I understood, but the last thing I wanted was a mistaken shooting. I carefully keyed my vox and whispered,
"Rex, you're not coming into the warehouse to find us, are you?"
"Negative, Inquisitor."
"Stand by."
Fischig had reached the top of the staircase. He peered down, aiming his weapon. Lasfire erupted through the floorboards next to him, and he threw himself flat.
I put a trio of shots into the mouth of the staircase, but my angle was bad. Two hard, round shots spat back up the stairs, and then the roar and flash of the las came again, raking the floor. From above, I realized belatedly. Whoever was on the stairs had a hard slug sidearm, but the las fire was coming down from the roof. I heard steps running on the floor below. Fischig scrambled up to give chase, but another salvo of las fire sent him ducking again. I raised my arm and fired up into the roof tiles, blowing out holes through which the pale light poked. Something slithered and scrambled on the roof. Fischig was on the stairs now, running after the second assailant. I hurried across the third floor, following the sounds of the man on the roof. I saw a silhouette against the sky through a hole in the tiles and fired again. Las fire replied in a bright burst, but then there was a thump and further slithering.
"Cease fire! Give yourself up! Inquisition!"
I bellowed, using the will. There came a much more substantial crash, sounding like a whole portion of the roof had come down. Tiles avalanched down and smashed in a room nearby. I slammed into the doorway, gun aimed, about to yell out a further will command, but there was no one in the room. Piles of shattered roof slates and bricks covered the floor beneath a gaping hole in the roof itself, and a battered las rifle lay amongst the debris. On the far side of the room were some of the broken windows that Beckwin had pointed out as overlooking the tannery roof. I ran to one. Down below, a powerful figure in dark overalls was running for cover. The killer, escaping from me in just the same way his last victim had escaped him, through the windows onto the tannery roof. The distance was too far to use the will again with any effect, but my aim and angle were good. I lined up on the back of the head a second before it disappeared, began to apply pressure, and the world exploded behind me. I came round, cradled in Beckwin's arms.
"Don't move, Eisenhorn. The medics are coming."
"What happened?"
I asked. "Booby trap.
The gun that guy left behind, it exploded behind you. Power cell overload."
"Did Fischig get his man?"
"Of course he did."
He hadn't, in fact.
He'd chased the man hard, down two flights of stairs and through the main floor of the warehall. At the outer door onto the street, the man had wheeled round and emptied his auto pistol's clip at the chasener, forcing him into cover. Then Captain Rex, approaching from outside, had gunned the man down in the doorway.
We assembled in Rex's crowded office in the busy RBT's mid-rise sector house. Amos joined us, laden down with papers and data slates, and brought Midas Betancourt with him.
"You all right?"
Midas asked me. In his jacket of embroidered cerise silk, he was a vivid splash of color in the muted gloom of mid-rise. "Minor abrasions, I'm fine."
"I thought we were leaving, and here you are having all the fun without me."
"I thought we were leaving, too, until I saw this case. Review Beckwin's notes. I need you up to speed." Amos shuffled his ancient, augmetically assisted bulk over to Rex's desk and dropped his books and papers in an unceremonious pile.
"I've been busy," he said.
"Busy with results?" Beckwin asked. He looked at her sourly.
"No, actually. But I have gathered a commendable resource of information. As the discussion advances, I may be able to fill in blanks."
"No results, Amos. Most perturbatory,"
grinned Midas, his white teeth gleaming against his dark skin. He was mocking the old savant by using Amos's favorite phrase. I had before me the work roster of the warehouse where the three bodies had been found, and another for the agricultural store where our fight had occurred. Quick comparison brought up two coincident names.
"Brel Sadakis, Vim Venick, both worked as warehouse men before the place closed down. Now they're employed by Hundelmass Agricultural Stowage."
"Backgrounds? Addresses?" I asked Rex.
"I ran checks," she said.
"So, we have a cult here, eh?"
Midas asked.
"You've got a series of ritual killings, at least one murder site, and now the names of two possible cultists."
"Perhaps." I wasn't convinced. There seemed both more and less to this than had first appeared. Inquisitorial hunch. The remains of the las rifle discarded by my assailant lay on an evidence tray. Even with the damage done by the overloading power cell, it was apparent that this was an old model.
"Did the power cell overload because it was dropped?
It fell through the roof, didn't it?" Beckwin asked.
They're pretty solid,
Fischig answered. Forced overload, I said. An old Imperial Guard trick. I've heard they learn how to set one off. As a last ditch in tight spots, cornered, about to die anyway.
That's not standard,
said Fischig, poking at the trigger guard of the twisted weapon. His knowledge of guns was sometimes unseemly.
See this modification? It's been machine-tooled to widen the guard around the trigger.
Why? I asked. Fischig shrugged.
Access?
For an augmetic hand with rudimentary digits? We went through to a morgue room down the hall, where the man Rex had gunned down was lying on a slab. He was middle-aged, with a powerful frame going to seed. His skin was weather-beaten and lined. Identity?
We're working on it.
The body had been stripped by the morgue attendants. Fischig scrutinized it, rolling it with Rex's help to study the back. The man's clothes and effects were in plastine bags in a tray at his feet. I lifted the bag of effects and held it up to the light.
Tattoo, reported Fischig. Imperial Eagle, left shoulder. Crude. Old. Letters underneath it. Capital S, period. Capital I, period. Capital I. Capital X.
I just found the signet ring in the bag. Gold, with a wheat ear motif.
S-I-I-X, said Amos. Sameter Infantry 9.
The 9th Sameter Infantry had been founded in Urbitane 23 years before, and had served, as Amos had already told me, in the brutal liberation war on Cerealis 6. According to city records, 519 veterans of that war and that regiment had been repatriated to Sameter after mustering out 13 years ago, coming back from the horrors of war to an increasingly depressed world beset by the blight of poverty and urban collapse. Their regimental emblem, as befitted a world once dominated by agriculture, was the wheat ear.
They came back 13 years ago. The oldest victim we have dates from that time, said Fischig.
Cerealis 6 was a hard campaign, wasn't it? I asked. Amos nodded.
The enemy was dug in. It was ferocious, brutal, brutalizing. And the climate. Two white dwarf suns, no cloud cover. The most punishing heat and light, not to mention ultraviolet burning.
Ruins the skin, I murmured. Makes it weather-beaten and prematurely aged. Everyone looked at the taut, lined face of the body on the slab.
I'll get a list of the veterans, volunteered Rex. I already have one, said Amos.
I'm betting you find the names Brel Sodakis and Vim Venik on it, I said. Amos paused as he scanned.
I do, he agreed.
What about Quater Traves?
Yes, he's here. Master Gunnery Sergeant Quater Traves.
What about Omin Lund?
Yes, sniper, first class. Invalided out of service.
The Sameter 9th were a mixed unit, then? Asked Beckwin.
All our guard foundings are, Rex said proudly.
So, these men, and women, Midas mused, soldiers, been through hell, fighting the corruption. Your idea is they brought it back here with them. Some taint. You think they were infected by the touch of the warp on Cerealis, and have been ritually killing as a way of worship back here ever since?
No, I said. I think they're still fighting the war. It remains a sad truth of the Imperium that virtually no veteran ever comes back from fighting its wars intact. Combat alone shreds nerves and shatters bodies. But the horrors of the warp, and of foul Xenos forms like the Tyranid, steal sanity forever, and leave veterans fearing the shadows, and the night, and, sometimes, the nature of their friends and neighbors for the rest of their lives. The guards of the 9th Sameter Infantry had come home 13 years before, broke by a savage war against mankind's arch-enemy, and, through their scars and their fear, brought the war back with them. The Arbites mounted raids at once on the addresses of all the veterans on the list, those that could be traced, those that were still alive. It appeared that skin cancer had taken over 200 of them in the years since their repatriation. Cerealis had claimed them as surely as if they had fallen there in combat. A number were rounded up. Bewildered drunks, cripples, addicts, a few honest men and women trying diligently to carry on with their lives. For those latter I felt especially sorry. But about 70 could not be traced. Many may have disappeared, moved on, or died without it coming to the attention of the authorities. But some had clearly fled. Lund, Traves, Sadakis, Venick, for starters. Their habs were found abandoned, strewn with possessions, as if the occupant had left in a hurry. So were the habs of 20 more belonging to names on the list. The Arbetes arrived at the hab of one, ex-Corporal Geffin Sancto, in time to catch him in the act of flight. Sancto had been a flamer operator in the guard, and like so many of his kind, had managed to keep his weapon as a memento. Screaming the battle cry of the Samiter Ninth, he torched four Arbetes in the stairwell of his building before the tactical squads of the judiciary vaporized him in a hail of gunshots.
"Why are they killing?" Beckwin asked me. "All these years in secret ritual."
"I don't know."
"You do, Eisenhorn. You so do."
"Very well. I can guess. The fellow worker who jokes at the Emperor's expense and makes your fragile sanity imagine he is tainted with the warp. The rug maker whose patterns suggest to you the secret encoding of chaos symbols. The midwife, you decide, is spawning the offspring of the arch-enemy in the mid-rise maternity hall. The traveling evangelist, who seems just too damn fired up to be safe." She looked down at the floor of the landspeeder.
"They see demons everywhere."
"In everything. In everyone. And so help them. They believe they are doing the Emperor's work by killing. They trust no one, so they daren't alert the authorities. They take the eyes, the hands, and the tongue, all the organs of communication, any way the arch-enemy might transmit his foul lies. And then they destroy the brain and heart, the organs which common soldier myth declares must harbor demons."
"So where are we going now?" she asked.
"Another hunch." The guild hall of the Samiter Agricultural Fraternity was a massive ragstone building on Furnace Street, its facade decaying from the ministrations of smog and acid rain. It had been disused for over 2 decades. Its last duty had been to serve as a recruitment post of the Samiter Ninth during the founding. In its long hallways, the men and women of the Ninth had signed their names, collected their starchy new fatigues, and pledged their battle oath to the God Emperor of mankind. At certain times, under certain circumstances, when a proper altar to the Emperor is not available, guard officers improvise in order to conduct their ceremonies. An imperial eagle, an aquila standard, is suspended from a wall, and a sacred spot is marked on the floor beneath in yellow chalk. The guild hall was not a consecrated building. The founding must have been the first time the young volunteers of Urbitane had seen that done. They'd made their vows to a yellow chalk cross and a dangling aquila. Reg was leading 3 fire teams of armed Arbetes, but I went in with Midas and Fishig first, quietly. Beckwin and Amos stayed by our vehicle. Midas was carrying his matched needle pistols, and Fishig an auto shotgun. I clipped a slab pattern magazine full of fresh rounds into the precious bolt pistol given to me by Librarian Britnoth of the Adeptus Astartes Death Watch chapter. We pushed open the boarded doors of the decaying structure and edged down the dank corridors. Rainwater pattered from the roof, and the marble floor was spotted and eaten by collected acid. We could hear the singing. A couple of dozen voices voicing up the battle hymn of the Golden Throne. I led my companions forward, hunched low. Through the crazed windows of an inner door, we looked through into the main hall. 23 disheveled veterans in ragged clothes were knelt down in ranks on the filthy floor. Their heads bowed to the rusty imperial eagle hanging on the wall as they sang. There was a yellow chalk cross on the floor under the aquila. Each veteran had a backpack or rucksack and a weapon by their feet. My heart ached. This was how it had gone over 2 decades before, when they came to the service, young and fresh and eager, before the war, before the horror.
"Let me try. Try to give them a chance," I said.
"Gregor,"
Midas hissed.
"Let me try. For their sake. Cover me."
I slipped into the back of the hall, my gun lowered at my side, and joined in the verse. One by one, the voices died away, and bowed heads turned sideways to look at me. Down the aisle, at the chalk cross of the altar, Lund, Traves, and a bearded man I didn't know stood gazing at me. In the absence of other voices, I finished the hymn. "It's over," I said. "The war is over, and you have all done your duty, above and beyond the call." Silence. "I am Inquisitor Eisenhorn. I'm here to relieve you. The careful war against the blight of chaos that you have waged through Urbitain in secret is now over. The Inquisition is here to take over. You can stand down." Two or three of the hunched veterans began to weep.
"You lie," said Lund, stepping forward.
"I do not. Surrender your weapons, and I promise you will be treated fairly and with respect."
Will we get medals?"
the bearded man asked, in a quavering voice. "The gratitude of the God Emperor will be with you always." More were weeping now, out of fear, anxiety, or plain relief.
"Don't trust him," said Traves. "It's another trick."
"I saw you in my bar," said Lund, stepping forward. "You came in looking."
Her voice was empty, distant. "I saw you on the tannery roof, Omin Lund. You're still a fine shot, despite the hand." She looked down at her prosthetic with a wince of shame.
"Will we get medals?"
the bearded man repeated, eagerly. Traves turned on him.
"Of course we won't spake, you cretin. He's here to kill us."
"I'm not," I began.
"I want medals,"
the bearded man, spake, screamed suddenly, sliding his las pistol up from his belt with the fluid speed only a trained soldier can manage. I had no choice. His shot tore through the shoulder padding of my storm coat. My bolt exploded his head, spraying blood across the rusty metal eagle on the wall. Pandemonium. The veterans leapt to their feet, firing wildly, scattering, running. I threw myself flat as shots tore out the wall plaster behind me. At some point, Fischig and Midas burst in, weapons blazing. I saw three or four veterans drop, sliced through by silent needles, and another six tumble as shotgun rounds blew them apart. Traves came down the aisle, blasting his old service-issue las rifle at me. I rolled and fired, but my shot went wide. His face distorted as a needle round punched through it, and he fell in a crumpled heap. Rex and her fire teams exploded in. Flames from some spilled accelerants billowed up the wall. I got up, and then was thrown back by a las shot that blew off my left hand. Spinning, falling, I saw Lund, struggling to make her prosthetic fingers work the unmodified trigger of Traves' las gun. My bolt round hit her with such force she flew back down the aisle, hit the wall, and tore the Imperial Aquila down. Not a single veteran escaped the Guildhall alive. The firefight raged for 2 hours. Rex lost 5 men to the experienced guns of the Samiter 9th veterans. They stood to the last. No more can be said of any Imperial Guard unit. The whole affair left me sour and troubled. I have devoted my life to the service of the Imperium, to protect it against its manifold foes, inside and out, but not against its servants. However misguided, they were loyal and true. However wrong, they were shaped that way by the service they had endured in the Emperor's name. Lund cost me my hand. A hand for a hand. They gave me a prosthetic on Samiter. I never used it. For 2 years I made do with a fused stump. Surgeons on Messina finally gave me a fully functional graft. I consider it still a small price to pay for them. I have never been back to Samiter. Even today, they are still finding the secreted, hidden bodies. So very many, dead, in the Emperor's name. That was Missing in Action, by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. Backcloth, for a Crown Additional. Written by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. Lord Freuger much to everyone's dismay, including, I'm sure, his own, was dead. It was a dry summer morning in 355.M41, and I was taking breakfast with Elizabeth Beckwin on the terrace of Spayton House when I received the news. The sky was a blurry blue, the colour of Sameter ware porcelain, and down in the bay the water was a pale lilac, shot through with glittering frills of silver. Sand doves warbled from the drowsy shade of the estate orchards. Jubal Kircher, my craggy, dependable chief of household security, came out into the day's heat from the garden room, apologized courteously for interrupting our private meal, and handed me a folded square of thin transmission paper.
"Trouble?"
asked Beckwin, pushing aside her dish of ploying crepes. "Freuger's dead," I replied, studying the missive.
"Freuger who?"
"Lord Freuger, of House Freuger."
"You knew him?"
"Very well. I would count him as a friend. Well, how very miserable. Dead at 82. That's no age."
"Was he ill?" Beckwin asked.
"No. Ain Freuger was, if anything, maddeningly robust and healthy. Not a scrap of augmetics about him. You know the sort." I made this remark pointedly. My career had not been kind to my body. I had been repaired, rebuilt, augmented, and generally sewn back together more times than I cared to remember. I was a walking testimonial to Imperial Medicare reconstruction surgery. Elizabeth, on the other hand, still looked like a woman in her prime, a beautiful woman at that, and only the barest minimum of juvenile work had preserved her so. According to this, he died following a seizure at his home last night. His family are conducting thorough investigations, of course, but... I drummed my fingers on the tabletop.
"Foul play."
"He was an influential man."
"Such men have enemies."
"And friends," I said. I handed her the communique. "That's why his widow has requested my assistance." But for my friendship with Ain, I'd have turned the matter down. Elizabeth had only just arrived on Gudrun, after an absence of almost 18 months, and would be gone again in a week, so I had resolved to spend as much time with her as possible. The operational demands of the distaff, based on Messina, kept her away from my side far more than I would have liked. But this was important, and Lady Freuger's plea too distraught to ignore.
"I'll come with you," Elizabeth suggested. "I feel like a jaunt in the country."
She called for a staff car to be brought round from the stable block, and we were on our way in under an hour. Philippe Gabon, one of Kirsch's security detail, acted as our driver. He guided the car up from Spayton on a whisper of thrust and laid in a course for Menizaire. Soon we were cruising southwest over the forest tracks and the verdant cultivated belt outside Dorset and leaving the Insume headland behind. In the comfortable climate-controlled rear cabin of the staff car, I told Elizabeth about Freuger. "There have been Freugers on Gudrun since the days of the first colonies. Their house is one of the 26 venerables, that is to say, one of the 26 original noble fiefs, and as such has an hereditary seat in the upper legislature of the planetary government. Other newer houses have considerably more power and land these days, but nothing can quite eclipse the prestige of the venerables. Houses like Freuger, Sangral, Messian, and Glor." She smiled impishly at my inclusion of that last name.
"So, power, land, prestige?
A honey trap for rivals and enemies.
Did your friend have any?"
I shrugged. I'd brought with me several data slates Sulis had looked out for me from the library. They contained heraldic ledgers, family histories, biographies and memoirs, and very little that seemed pertinent. House Freuger vied with House Athensay and House Brudish in the early years of Gudrun, but that's literally ancient history. Besides, House Brudish became extinct after another feud with House Pariti 800 years ago. Ain's grandfather famously clashed with Lord Sangral and the then-governor Lord Dougray over the introduction of founding levy in the 190s, but that was just political, though Dougray never forgave him and later snubbed him by making Richtian chancellor. In recent times, House Freuger has been very much a quiet, solid traditional seat in the legislature. No feuds that I know of. In fact, there hasn't been an inter-house war on Gudrun for 7 generations.
They all play nicely together these days, do they?
She asked. Pretty much. One of the things I like about Gudrun is that it's so damned civilized.
Too damned civilized, she admonished. One day, Gregor, one day, this place will lull you into such a deep sense of tranquil seclusion that you'll be caught with your pants down.
I hardly think so. It's not complacency, before you jump down my throat. Gudrun, Spaten House itself, is just a safe place. A sanctuary, given my line of work.
Your friend's still dead, she reminded me.
I sat back. He liked to live well. Good food, fine wines. He could drink ale under the table.
No,
I'm not joking. 5 years ago, at the wedding of Ain's daughter, I was invited and I took Harlan along as I don't know what, actually. You weren't around and I didn't want to go alone. Harlan started bending his lordship's ear with tales of bounty hunting, and the last I saw of them, they were sprinting their way down their fourth bottle of anise at 5 in the morning. Ain was up at 9 the next day to see his daughter off. Nail was still asleep at 9 the following day. She grinned. So, a life of great appetites may have just caught up with him.
Perhaps, though you'd think that would have shown up on the Medice Mortis's report.
So you do suspect foul play?
I can't shake that idea.
I was silent for a few minutes, and Elizabeth scrolled her way through several of the slates.
House Freuger's main income was from mercantile dealings. They hold a 12-point stock in Braid on Sigh, and a 15% share in Helican Subsid Shipping. What about trade rivals?
We'd have to expand our scope off-planet. I suppose assassination is possible, but that's a strange way to hit back at a trade rival. I'll have to examine their records. If we can turn up signs of a clandestine trade fight, then maybe assassination is the answer.
Your friend spoke out against the Ophidian campaign.
So did his father. Neither believed it was appropriate to divert funds and manpower into a war of reconquest in the subsector next door, when there was so much to put in order on the home front.
I was just wondering, she said.
Wonder away, but I think that's a dead end. The Ophidian War's long since over and done with, and I don't think anyone cares what Ain thought about it.
So, you have got a theory?
Only the obvious ones. None of them with any substantiating data. An internecine feud, targeting Ain from inside the family. A murder driven by some secret affair of the heart. A darker conspiracy that remains quite invisible for now.
Or?
Too much good living. In which case we'll be home before nightfall. Freuger Hall, the ancestral pile of the noble House Freuger, was a splendid stack of ivy-swathed ouzelite and copper tiles overlooking the Vale of Feig, 10 kilometers south of Menizere. Water meadows sloped back from the river, becoming wildflower pastures that climbed through spinneys of larch and fintel to hem the magnificent planned gardens of the house. Geometric designs of box hedge, trim lawn, flowering beds and symmetrical ponds. Beyond the sandy drive, darkened woods came right down to skirt the back of the great hall, except for where a near-perfect sullock lawn had been laid. Ain and I had spent several diverting afternoons there, playing against each other. A kilometre north of the house, the gnarled stone finger of the folly rose from the ascending woods.
"Where to put down, sir?"
Gabon asked over the intercom. "On the drive in front of the portico, if you'd be so kind."
"What's been going on here?" Elizabeth asked, as we came in lower. She pointed.
The lawn areas nearest to the hall were littered with scraps of rubbish, paper waste and glittery bits of foil. Some sections of grass were flat and yellow, as if compressed and starved of light. Tiny stones, whipped up by our downwash, ticked off the car's bodywork as we settled in to land.
"Oh, my dear Gregor!"
Lady Frail Freuger almost fell into my arms. I had held her in a comforting embrace for a few patient moments as she sobbed against my chest.
"Forgive me," she said suddenly,
pulling away and dabbing her eyes with a black lace handkerchief.
"This is all so very terrible, so very, very terrible."
"My deepest sympathies for your loss, lady," I said, feeling awkward. A houseman, his arm banded in black, had led us into a stateroom off the main hall, where Lady Freuger was waiting. The blinds were drawn, and morning tapers had been lit, filling the air with a feeble light and a sickly perfume. Frail Freuger was a stunning woman in her late 60s, her lush red hair, almost flame pink it was so bright, pulled back and pinned down under a veil quiff of jet scamisoire. Her grief gown was slate Epinshire, the sleeves ending in delicate interwoven gloves, so that not one speck of her flesh was uncovered. I introduced Elizabeth, who murmured her condolences, and Lady Freuger nodded. Then she suddenly looked flustered.
"Oh, my, where are my manners? I should have the staff bring refreshments for you, and—"
"Hush, lady," I said, taking her arm and walking her down the long room into the soft shade of the shutters. "You have enough on your mind. Grief is enough. Tell me what you know, and I will do the rest."
"You're a good man, sir. I knew I could trust you."
She paused and waited while her current racks subsided.
"Ain died just before midnight last night. A seizure. It was quick, the physician said."
"What else did he say, lady?" She drew a data wand from her sleeve and handed it to me.
"It's all here."
I plucked out my slate and plugged it in. The display lit up with the stored files. Death by tremorous palpitations of the heart and mind. A dysfunction of the spirit. According to the Medicaid's report, Ain Freuger had died because of a spasm in his anima. "This means," I paused, "nothing. Who is your physician?"
"Generous Notil, of Menizere. He has been the family Medicaid since the time of Ain's grandfather."
"His report is rather non-specific, lady. Could I present the body for a further examination?"
"I've already done that," she said softly.
"The surgeon at Menizere General who attended said the same.
My husband died of terror."
"Terror?"
"Yes, Inquisitor. Now, tell me that isn't the work of the infernal powers."
There had, she told me, been a celebration. A grand fate. Ain's eldest son, Rinton, had returned home 2 weeks before, having mustered out of his service in the Imperial Guard. Rinton Freuger had been a captain in the 50th Gudrunite and seen 6 years' service in the Ophidian subsector. Such was his father's delight on his return, a fete was called, a carnival feast. Travelling players from all around the canton had attended, along with troops of musicians, acrobats, armies of stallholders, entertainers, and hundreds of folk from the town. That explained the litter and faded patches on the lawn. Tent pitches. The scars of marquees. "Had he any enemies?" I asked, pacing the shuttered room.
"Not that I know of."
"I would like to review his correspondence. Diaries, too, if he kept them."
"I see. I don't believe he kept a diary.
But our rubricator will have a list of correspondents." On the top of the harpsichord was a framed portrait. A hololith of Ain Freuger, smiling. I picked it up and studied it.
"The last portrait of him," she said. "Taken at the fete. My last connection with him."
"Where did he die?"
"The Folly,"
said Lady Freuger.
"He died in the Folly."
The woods were damp and dark. Boughs creaked in the late afternoon wind, and odd birdsong thrilled from the shadows. The Folly was a stone drum capped by a slate needle. Inside, it was bare and terribly musty. Sand doves fluttered up in the roof spaces. Cobwebs glazed the bare windows.
"This is where I found him," said a voice from behind me.
I turned. Rinton Freuger stooped in under the doorframe. He was a well-made boy of 25, with his mother's lush red hair. His eyes had a curious, hooded aspect. "Rinton?"
"Sir?"
He bowed slightly. "Was he dead when you found him?"
"No, Inquisitor. He was laughing and talking. He liked to come up here. He loved the Folly. I came up to thank him for the fate he had thrown in my honour. We were talking together when suddenly he went into convulsions. Just minutes later, before I could summon help, he was dead."
I didn't know Rinton Freuger well, though his service record was very respectable, and I knew his father had been proud of him. Ain had never mentioned any animosity from his son, but in any noble house there is always the spectre of succession to consider. Rinton had been alone with his father at the time of death. He was a seasoned soldier, undoubtedly no stranger to the act of killing. I kept an open mind, literally,
Even without any invasive mental probing, it is possible for a psionic of my ability to sense surface thoughts. There was no flavor of deceit about Rinton's person, though I could feel carefully contained loss and the tingle of trepidation. Small wonder, I considered. Uncommon are the citizens of the Imperium who do not register anxiety at being quizzed by an inquisitor of the Holy Ordos. There was no point pressing him now. Rinton's story might easily be put to the test with an auto-seance, during which psychometric techniques would simply reveal the truth of his father's last moments to me. Rinton walked me back to the hall, and left me to my ponderings in Ayn's study. It was as he had left it, I was told. The room was half-panelled and lined, for the most part, with glazed shelves of neatly bound books and data slates. Discreet glow-globes hovered around the edges of the room at head height, set to a low luminosity, and a selection of scroll-backed couches and overstuffed chairs were arranged in front of the high-throated ceramic fireplace with its wood-burning fusion stove. The desk, under the diamond-paned west windows, was a wide crescent of polished duralloy, floated a meter off the carpet by passive suspensor pods. The desk was clean and bare. I sat at it, depressing slightly the hydraulics of the writing chair. I was half a head taller than Ayn Freuger. I studied the mirror-smooth, slightly raked surface of the desk. There was no sign of any control panel, but a gentle wave of my hand across it woke up heat-sensitive touch plates engraved into the duralloy's finish. I touched a few, but they needed Ayn's touch, probably a combination of palm print and gene key, to unlock them. That, or Inquisition-grade software. I unpinned my inquisitorial rosette, which I had been wearing on the sternum of my black leather coat, and slid open the signal port. Holding it low over the desk, I force-fed the touch plates with several magenta-level security override programs. It gave up the fight almost at once, opening systems without even the need for passwords. Built into the stylish desk, an item of furniture that had clearly cost Ayn a lot of money, was a fairly powerful cogitator, a Vox-picked uplink, a message archive, two filing archives, and a master control for the simple, limited electronic systems built into the hall. Separate pages of each file and message could be displayed as a facsimile on the blotter plate, and a touch of a finger turned them or put them away. Ayn had destroyed all paper records. I played with it for some time, but the most interesting thing I found was a log of invoices for services provided at the fete, and a list of the invitations. I copied both into my own data slate. Elizabeth and Gabon arrived when I was busy with that. Elizabeth had been interviewing the household staff, and Gabon had been out, walking the grounds.
"There were over 900 guests here, sir," he said, "and maybe another 500 players, musicians, entertainers, and carnival folk."
"Where from?"
"Menizere, mostly," he replied. "Local entertainers, a few troubadours and some street tumblers from the bi-weekly textile market. The biggest individual groups were Calakin's company, an acclaimed troupe of travelling actors, and Sunsible's touring fair, who provided the games and rides and diversions."
I nodded. Gabon was as thorough as usual. A short, spare man in his 150s, with cropped black hair and a bushy moustache. He had been with the D'Orsay Arbites for about 70 years before retiring into private service. He wore a simple, refined, dark blue suit that had been ingeniously tailored to hide the fact that he was wearing a handgun in a shoulder rig. "What about you?" I asked Elizabeth. She sat down on one of the couches. "Nothing scintillating. The staff seemed genuinely shocked and upset at the death. They all react with outrage at the idea your friend might have had any enemies." "It seems quite clear to me that he did have some," I said. Elizabeth reached into the folds of her gown and fished out a small, hard object. She tossed it across onto the desktop, and it landed with a tap. There it extended 4 multi-jointed limbs and scurried across onto my palm. I turned the wriggling poison snooper over and pressed the recessed stud on its belly. A little ball of hololithic energy coalesced above its head-mounted projector, and I read it as it slowly scrolled around on its own axis. Traces of Low, Obscura, and several other Class 2 and 3 narcotics in the garden area and the staff quarters. Penshell seed traces found in the stable block. more low, as well as listeria and E. coli in small amounts in the kitchen section. Elizabeth shrugged. The usual mix of recreational drugs one might expect, none in large quantities, and the kitchen's as hygienic as anywhere. You'd probably get the same sort of readings from Speighton House. Probably. Penshell seeds. They're quite unusual. A very mild stimulant, said Gabon. I didn't know anyone still used that stuff. Time was it was the drug of choice in the artist's quarter of Dorset, back when I was on the force. The seeds are dried, rolled, and smoked in pipes. A little bohemian. An old man's smoke. Most of the outdoor traces can be put down to the visiting entertainers, I mused. Plus a little off-duty pleasure from the staff or loose-living guests. What about the stable block? Are any of Freuger's ostlers Penshell smokers? Elizabeth shook her head. They cleared large parts of the stable area to provide spaces for the fair stallholders. I put the snooper down on the desk, and it wriggled back and forth for a few moments, until it got enough purchase to right itself. So, nothing untoward, in fact. And certainly no significant toxins.
None at all, said Elizabeth.
Damn. Given the description of Ayn's death, I had been quite sure poison was the key. Perhaps some assassin's sophisticated toxin that had not shown up on the initial Medicaid report. But Elizabeth's snooper was high grade and thorough.
What do we do now? She asked.
I passed her my data slate. Send the contents of this to Amos by direct Voxlink. See what he can come up with. Uber Amos was my ancient and trusted savant. If anyone could see a pattern or make a connection, it was him. Evening fell. I went outside, alone. I felt annoyed and frustrated. In fact, I felt thwarted. I'd come there as a favor to my old friend's widow, offering my services, and in most respects I was overqualified. I was an Imperial Inquisitor, and this was most likely just a job for the local Arbites. I had expected to have the entire matter sewn up in a few hours, to settle things swiftly in a quick, unofficial investigation, and leave with the thanks of the family for sparing them a long, drawn-out inquest. But the clues just weren't there. There was no motive, no obvious antagonist, no aggressor, but it still seemed likely that Ayn Freuger had been killed. I looked at the Medicaid report again, hoping to find something that would establish natural causes. Nothing. Something, someone, had taken my friend's life. But I couldn't tell what or who or why. The evening skies were dark, stained a deep violet, and smeared with chasing milky clouds. An early moon shone, passing behind the running trails of cloud every minute or so. A wind was gathering, and the stands of trees beside the lawn were beginning to sway and swish. The leaves made a cold sound, like rain. I walked over to my flyer, popped the cargo trunk, and took out Barbarisata. I slowly freed it from its silk bindings and drew the long, gleaming blade from its machined scabbard. Barbarisata had been an heirloom sword, a psychically attuned weapon from the forges of distant Carthay, and slaved to the minds of the generations of warrior women who had wielded it. Enhancing its strength with pentagramic wards, I had used the long saber in my battle against the heretic Quixos, during which struggle it had been broken below the tip. Master swordsmiths had remade the blade from the broken main portion, creating a shorter, straighter blade by rounding off and edging the break and reducing the hilt. A good deal smaller than its old self, now more a single-handed rapier than a hand-and-a-half saber, it was still a potent weapon. Naked in my hand, it hummed and whined as my mind ran through it and made it resonate. The incised wards glowed and sobbed out faint wisps of smoke. I walked out over the grass under the seething trees, holding the blade out before me like a dowsing rod, sweeping the scene, letting the blade tip slide along the invisible angles of space. Twice, on my circuit for the lawns, it twitched, as if tugged by sprite hands, but I could discern nothing from the locations. But there was something there. My first hint of a malign focus. My first hint that not only was foul play involved, but that Lady Freuger might be right. Though they had only left the slightest traces behind them, infernal powers had been at work here. Elizabeth came into my room at 8 the next morning, She woke me by sitting down on the side of my bed and handed me a cup of hot black caffeine as I roused. She was already dressed and ready for work. The day was bright. I could hear the household coming to life, pans clattering in the kitchen block, and the butler calling to his pages in the nearby gallery.
"Bad storm in the night," she said. "Brought trees down."
"Really?" I grumbled, sitting up and sipping the sweet, dark caffeine. I looked at her. It wasn't like Beckwin to be so perky this early.
"Out with it," I said.
She handed me a data slate. "Amos has been busy. Must have worked all night."
"Through the storm?"
"There was no storm up his way. It was local." I didn't really hear that reply. I was caught up in a close reading of the slate. Failing to cross-match just about every detail I had sent him, Amos had clearly become bored. The list of guests I had sent him had led to nothing, despite his best efforts to make connections. The caterers and performers had revealed nothing either. No links to the underworld or cult activity, no misdeeds or priors, except for the usual clutch of innocent and minor violations one might expect. One of the travelling actors had been charged with a fray 20 years before, and another had done time for grievous wounding, that sort of thing. The only item that had flagged any sort of connection was the description of Ayn Froiger's death. Amos had only turned to that rather vague clue once he'd exhausted all others. In the past 20 months, 11 people in the Drunna region of Gudrun, which is to say the coastal area encompassing Menizere, Dorsey, and Insium, all the way to Madua Chapeltown, had died of a similar mystery ailment. Only a tight, deliberate search like the one Amos had conducted would have shown up such a connection, given the scale of area involved and the size of population. Listed together, the deaths stood out like a sore thumb. Here, Amos had come into his own. Another clerk might have sent those findings to me and waited for direction, but Amos, hungry to answer the questions himself, had pressed on, trying to make a pattern out of them. No simple task. There was nothing to demographically or geographically link the victims. A housewife here, a millkeeper there, a landowner in one small village, a community doctor in another, 70 kilometers away. The only thing they had in common was the sudden, violent, and inexplicable nature of their demises, seizures, abrupt, fatal. I set down my cup and scrolled on, aware that Elizabeth was grinning at me.
"Get to the last bit," she advised. "Amos strikes again."
Right at the last, Amos revealed another connection. A day or two before each death, the victim's locality had been paid a visit by Sunsible's touring fair. Lady Froiger was most perturbed to see us about to leave.
"There are questions here still," she began.
"And I'm going to seek the answers," I said. "Trust me, I believe my savant has hit upon something." She nodded, unhappy. Rinton stepped forward and put his arm around his mother's shoulders. "Trust me," I repeated, and walked out across the drive to my waiting flyer. I could hear the sound of chain blades, and turned from the car to walk around the side of the hall. One of the trees brought down in the night's freak storm had crushed part of the stable block, and the housemen were working to saw up the huge trunk and clear it. "Is that where you detected Penchel seed?" I asked Elizabeth when she came to find out what was keeping me.
"Yes," she said.
"Fetch my blade." I called the housemen away from their work and walked into the collapsed ruin of the stable, crunching over heaps of coarse sawdust. The ivy-clad tree still sprawled through the burst roof. Elizabeth brought me Barbarisata, and I drew it quickly. By then Lady Froiger and Rinton Froiger had emerged to see what I was doing. Barbarisata hummed in my hand, louder and more throatily than it had done the previous night. As soon as I entered that part of the stable block, the particular stall the tree had smashed, it jumped. The taste of chaos was here. "What was this used for?" I asked. "During the fete? What was this area used for?"
"Storage," said Lady Froiger. "The people from the fair wanted to keep equipment and belongings out of sight. Food, too, I think. One man had trays of fresh figs he wanted to keep out of the light."
"And the hololithographer," said Rinton. "He used one of those stalls as a darkroom."
"So, how do you find a travelling fair in an area the size of the Drunner region. If you have a copy of their most recent invoice, it's easy. The fairmaster, eager to be paid for his services at Freuger Hall, had left as a payment address an inn 80 kilometres away in Seabrood. From the invoice, I saw that Ain had been asked to mail the payment within 5 days. The fare moved around a great deal, and the travelling folk didn't believe much in the concept of credit accounts. From Seabrood, we got a fix on the location of Sunsible's fare. They had pitched on a meadow outside the village of Brood Martin, a little rustic community of cat herds and weavers that was flanked by a lush deciduous woodland hillside to the east and marshy cattle-tramped fields below at the river spill to the west. It was late afternoon on a hot, close day, the air edged with the heavy, fulminous threat of storms. The sky was dark overhead, but the corn was bright and golden down in the meadows, and pollen balls blew in the breeze like thistle fibres. Grain crakes whooped in the corn stands, and small warblers of the most intense blue darted across the hedges. Gabon lowered the limo to rest in a lane behind the village kirk, a pale, low Gothic temple in need of upkeep. A noble statue of the Emperor Immaculate stood in the overgrown graveyard, a roost for wood doves. I buckled on my sword and covered it with a long leather cloak. Gabon locked the car. "Stay with me," I told Elizabeth, and then turned to Gabon. "Shadow us."
"Yes, sir."
We walked down the lane towards the fair. Even from a distance, we could hear the noise and feel the energy. The arrival of the fair had brought the folk of Brood Martin and the neighbouring hamlets out in force. Pipe organs were trilling and wheezing in the lank air, and there was the pop and whiz of firecrackers. I could hear laughter, the clatter of rides, the ringing of score bells, children screaming, rowdy men carousing, pistons hissing. The smell of warm ale wafted from the tavern tent. The gate in the meadow's hedge had been turned into an entranceway, arched with a gaudy, hand-painted sign that declared Sunsible's miraculous fair of fairs open. A white-eyed twist at the gateway took our coins for admission. Inside, on the meadow, all manner of bright, vulgar sights greeted us. The carousel, lit up with gas lamps, the ring-toss, the neat pink box tent of the clairvoyant, the churning hoop of the whirligig, spilling out the squeals of children, the colourful shouts of the freak-show barker, the burnt sugar smell of floss-makers, the clang of test-your-strength machines. For a penny, you could ride the shoulders of a battle titan, actually an agricultural servitor armoured with painted sections of rusty silage hopper. For another penny, you could shoot greenskins in the Laz Gallery, or touch the real and completely genuine shinbone of Macarius, or dunk for ploins. For tuppence, you could gaze into the eye of terror and have your heroism judged by a hooded man with a stutter who claimed to be an ex-space marine. The eye of terror in this case was a pit dug in the ground and filled with chemical lamps and coloured glass filters. Nearby, a small donation allowed you to watch an oiled man struggle free from chains, or a burning sack, or a tin bathtub full of broken glass, or a set of stocks.
"Just a penny, sir, just a penny,"
howled a man on stilts with a harlequined face as he capered past me.
"For the young lady."
I decided not to ask what my penny might buy.
"I want to go and look at the freak show,"
Elizabeth told me. "Save your money. It's all around us," I growled. We pushed on. Coloured balloons drifted away over the field into the encroaching darkness of the thunderhead. Corn crickets rasped furiously in the trampled stalks all about us. Drunken, painted faces swam at us, some lacking teeth, some with glittering, augmetic eyes.
"Over there," I whispered to Elizabeth.
Past the brazier stand of a woman selling paper cones of sugared nuts, and a large handcart stacked with wire cages full of songbirds, was a small booth tent of heavy red material erected at the side of a brightly painted trailer. A wooden panel raised on bunting-wrapped posts announced "Hololiths, most lifelike, most agreeable," below which a smaller notice said, "A most delightful gift, or a souvenir of the day, captured by the magic art of a master hololithographer." A frail old man with tufted white hair and small spectacles was seated outside the booth on a folding canvas chair, eating a meat pie that was so hot he had to keep blowing on it.
"Why don't you go and engage his interest?" I suggested.
Elizabeth left my side, pushed through the noisy crowd, and stopped by his booth. A sheet of flakboard had been erected beside the booth's entrance, and on it were numerous hololithic pictures mounted for display. Some miniatures, some landscapes, some family groups. Elizabeth studied them with feigned interest. The old man immediately leapt up off his chair, stowed the half-eaten pie behind the board, and brushed the crumbs off his robes. I moved round to the side, staying in the crowd, watching. I paused to examine the caged birds, though in fact I was looking through their cages at the booth tent. The old man approached Beckwin courteously.
"Madam, good afternoon. I see your attention has been arrested by my display of work. Are they not fairly framed and well composed?"
"Indeed," she said.
"You have a good eye, madam,"
he said.
"For so often in these country fairs the work of the hololithographer is substandard. The composition is frequently poor, and the plate quality fades with time. Not so with your humble servant. I have plied this trade of portraiture for 30 years, and I fancy I have skill for it. You see this print here? The lake shore at Entrieve?"
"It is a pleasing scene."
"You are very kind, madam. It is hand-coloured, like many of my frames. But this very print was made in the summer of 329, if my memory serves. And you'll appreciate there is no fading, no loss of clarity, no discoloration."
"It has preserved itself well."
"It has," he agreed merrily. "I have patented my own techniques, and I prepare the chemical compounds for the plates by hand, in my modest studio adjoining."
He gestured to his trailer.
"That is how I can maintain the quality and the perfect grade of the hololiths, and reproduce and print them to order, with no marked loss of standard from original to duplicate. My reputation rests upon it. Up and down the byways of the land, the name Bakunin is a watchword for quality portraiture."
Elizabeth smiled. "It's most impressive, Master Bakunin."
"And how much?" "Aha!" he grinned. "I thought you might be tempted, madam, and may I say it would be a crime for your beauty to remain unrecorded. My services are most affordable."
I moved round further, edging my way to the side of his booth, until he and Elizabeth were out of sight behind the awning. I could hear him still making his pitch to her. On the side of the trailer, further bold statements and enticements were painted in a flourishing script. A large sign read, "Portraits, 2 crowns, group scenes, 3 crowns, gilded miniatures, 1/2 crown only, offering many a striking and famous backcloth for 1 crown additional." I wandered behind the trailer. It was parked at the edge of the fairground, near to a copse of fintel and yew that screened the meadow from pastures beyond the ditch. It was damp and shaded here, small animals rustling in the thickets. I tried to look in at one small window, but it was shuttered. I touched the side of the trailer and felt Barbarisata twitch against my hip. There was a door near the far end of the trailer. I tried it, but it was locked.
"What's your business?" growled a voice.
3 burly fairground wranglers had approached along the copse side of the booths. They had been smoking low sticks behind their trailer on a break. "Not yours," I assured them.
"You had best be leaving Master Bakunin's trailer alone," one said.
All 3 were built like wrestlers, their bared arms stained with crude tattoos. I had no time for this.
"Go away now,"
I said, pitching my will through my voice. They all blinked, not quite sure what had happened to their minds, and then simply walked away as if I wasn't there. I returned my attention to the door and quickly forced the lock with my multi-key. To my surprise, the thin wooden door still refused to open. I wondered if it was bolted from inside, but as I put more weight into it, it did shift a little, enough to prove that there was nothing physical holding it. Then it banged back shut, as if drawn by immense suction. My pulse began to race. I could feel the sour tang of warpcraft in the air, and Barbarisata was now vibrating in its scabbard. It was time to dispense with subtleties. I paced around to the front of the booth, but there was no longer any sign of Beckwin or the old man. Stooping, I went in under the entrance flap. An inner drop curtain of black cloth stopped exterior light from entering the tent. I pushed that aside.
"I will be with you shortly, sir,"
Bakunin called.
"If you would give me a moment."
"I'm not a customer," I said. I looked around. The tent was quite small, and lit by the greenish glow of gas mantles that ran, I supposed, off the trailer supply. Elizabeth was sat at the far side on a ladder-backed chair with a drop-cloth of cream felt behind her. Bakunin was facing her, carefully adjusting his hololithic camera, a brass and teak machine mounted on a wooden tripod. He looked round at me curiously, his hands still polishing a brass-rimmed lens. Elizabeth rose out of her seat.
"Gregor?" she asked.
"The good lady is just sitting for a portrait, sir. It's all very civilized."
Bakunin peered at me, unsure what to make of me. He smiled and offered his hand.
"I am Bakunin, artist and hololithographer."
"I am Eisenhorn, Imperial Inquisitor."
"Oh,"
he said, and took a step backwards.
I...
"You're wondering why a servant of the Ordos has just walked into your booth," I finished for him. Bakunin's mind was like an open book. There was, I saw at once, no guile there, except for the natural money-making trickery of a fairground rogue. Whatever else he was, Bakunin was no heretic. "You took a portrait of Lord Freuger at the fete held on his lands just the other day," I said, thinking of the picture on the harpsichord back at the hall.
"I did,"
he said.
"His lordship was pleased. I made no charge for the work, sir. It was a gift to thank his lordship for his hospitality. I thought perhaps some of his worthy friends might see the work and want the like for themselves. I—"
"He doesn't know," I thought. "He has no clue what this is about. He's trying to work out how he might have drawn this investigation to himself." "Lord Freuger is dead," I told him. He went pale.
"No, that's...
"Master Bakunin, do you know if any of your other previous subjects have died? Died soon after your work was complete?"
"I don't, I'm sure. Sir, what are you implying?"
"I have a list of names," I said, unclipping my data slate. "Do you keep records of your work?"
"I keep them all. All the exposed plates, in case that copies or replacements are needed. I have full catalogues of all pictures."
I showed him the slate. "Do you recognize any of these names?" His hands were shaking. He said,
"I'll have to check them against my catalogue."
But I knew for a fact he'd recognize some of them at once. "Let's do that together," I said. Elizabeth followed us as we went through the back of the tent into the trailer. It was a dark, confined space, and Bakunin kept apologizing. Every scrap of surface, even the untidy flat of his little cot bed, was piled with spares and partly disassembled cameras. There was a musty chemical stink, mixed with the scent of pencil seeds. Bakunin's pipe lay in a small bowl. He reached into a crate under the cot and pulled out several dog-eared record books.
"Let me see now,"
he began. There was a door at the end of the little room. "What's through there?"
"My dark room, along with the file racks for the exposed plates."
"It has a door to the outside?"
"Yes,"
he said. "Locked?"
"No."
"You have an assistant, then? Someone you ordered to hold the door shut?"
"I have no assistant,"
he said, puzzled. "Open this door," I told him. He put down the books and went to the communicating door. Just from his body language, I could tell he had been expecting it to open easily.
"I don't understand,"
he said.
"It's never jammed before."
"Stand back," I said, and drew Barbara Sater. The exposed blade filled the little trailer with ozone, and Bakunin yelped. I put the blade through the door with one good swing and ripped it open. There was a loud bang of atmospheric decompression, and fetid air swept over us. A dark, smoky haze drifted out.
"Emperor of mankind, what is that?"
"Warp craft," I said. "You say you mix your own oxides and solutions?"
"Yes."
"Where do you get your supplies from?"
"Everywhere, here and there, sometimes from apothecaries or market traders or—"
"Anywhere." Bakunin had experimented with all manner of compounds over the years to create the best, most effective plates for his camera. He'd never been fussy about where the active ingredients came from. Something in his workshop, something in his rack of flasks and bottles, was tainted. I took a step towards the darkroom. In the half-light, things were flickering, half-formed and pale. The baleful energies lurking in Bakunin's workshop could sense I was a threat, and were trying to protect themselves by sealing the doors tight to keep me out. I crossed the threshold into the darkroom.
Elizabeth's cry of warning was lost in the shrieking of tormented air that suddenly swirled around me. Glass bottles and flasks of mineral tincture vibrated wildly in metal racks above Bakunin's workbench. Jars of liquid chemicals and unguent oils shattered and sprayed their contents into the air. The little gas jet burner flared and ignited, its rubber tube thrashing like a snake. Glass plates, each a square the size of a data slate, and each sleeved in a folder of tan card, were jiggling and working themselves out of the wooden racks on the far side of the blacked-out room. There were thousands of them, each one the master exposure of one of Bakunin's hololiths. The first yanked clear of the shelf, as if tugged by a sucking force, and I expected it to shatter on the floor, but it floated in the air. Quickly, others followed suit. Light from sources I couldn't locate played in the air, casting specks and flashes of color all around. The air itself became dark brown, like tobacco. I raised my sword. A negative plate came flying at my head, and I struck at it. Shards of glass flew in all directions. Another came at me, and I smashed that, too. More flew from the shelves like a spray of playing cards, whipping through the air towards me. I made a series of quick Uesa and Usa parries, bursting the glass squares as they struck in. I missed one, and it sliced my cheek with its edge before hitting the wall behind me like a throwing knife. "Get him out of here!" I yelled to Elizabeth. The trailer was shaking. Outside there was a crash of thunder, and rain started to hammer on the low roof. The hurtling plates were driving me back, and Barbarisata had become a blur in my hands as it struck out to intercept them all. Then the ghosts came. Serious men in formal robes, gentlewomen in long gowns, solemn children with pale faces, a laughing innkeeper with blotchy cheeks, two farmhands with their arms around each other's shoulders. More, still more, shimmering in the dirty air, made of smoke, their skins white, their clothes sepia, their expressions frozen at the moment they had been caught by the camera. They clawed and tugged at me with fingers of ice, pummeled me with psychokinetic fists. Some passed through me like wraiths, chilling my marrow. The malevolence hiding in that little trailer was conjuring up all the images Bakunin had immortalized in his career, ripping them off the negative plates and giving them form. I staggered back, tears appearing in my cloak. Their touch was as sharp as the edge of the glass plates. Their hollow screaming filled my ears. Then, with a sickening lurch, the world itself distorted and changed. The trailer was gone. For a moment I was standing on a sepia shoreline. Then I was an uninvited guest at a country wedding. My sword hacking and flashing, I stumbled on into a baptism, then a colorized view of the Atenate Mountains, then a feast in a guild hall. The ghosts surged at me, frozen hands clawing. The innkeeper with the blotchy cheeks got his icy fists around my throat, though his face was still open in laughter. I chopped Barbarisata through him, and he billowed like smoke. A sad-faced housemaid pulled at my arm, and a fisherman struck at me with his boat hook. I began to recite the litany of salvation, yelling it into the leering faces that beset me. A few crumpled and melted, like cellulose exposed to flame. I heard gunshots. Gabon was to my right, firing his weapon. He was standing on the pier at Dorsey at sunset, in the middle of an intervillage game of knockball and a harvest festival, all at the same time. The conflicting scenes blurred and merged around him. A bride and her groom, along with five mourners from a funeral and a retiring Arbites constable in full medals, were attacking him. "Get back!" I yelled. Barbarisata was glowing white-hot. Thunder crashed again, shaking the earth. Gabon shrieked as the bride's fingers ripped through his face, and as he stumbled backwards, whizzing glass plates chopped into him like axe heads. His blood was in the air, like rain. It flooded into the ghosts and stained their sepia tones crimson and their pale flesh pink. I felt fingers like knives draw across the flesh of my arms and back. There were too many of them. I couldn't trust my eyes. According to them, I was standing on a riverbank, and also the front steps of an administratum building. The locations overlaid each other impossibly, and neither was real. I leapt and lashed out with my blade. I hit something, tore through, and immediately found myself rolling on the rain-sodden turf behind the trailer. Lightning split the darkness overhead, and the rain was torrential. The storm and the bizarre activity around Bakunin's booth had sent the common folk fleeing from the meadow. The trailer was still vibrating and shaking, and oily brown smoke was gushing from the hole in the side wall I'd cut to break my way out. Inside, lights crackled and flashed, and the phantom screaming continued. The warp taint was berserk. Bakunin appeared, looking desperate, with Elizabeth close behind him. He put his hands to his mouth in shock at the sight of me, torn and bloodied. "Where is it?" I snarled.
"Third shelf up, above the workbench,"
he stammered.
"The green bottle. I needed tincture of mercury years ago, and an old woman in one of the villages gave it to me and said it would do as well. I use it all the time now. The emulsions it mixes are perfect. My work has never been better."
He looked down at the grass, shaking and horrified.
"I should have realized,"
he muttered.
"I should have realized. No matter how much I used, the bottle never emptied."
"Third shelf up," I confirmed.
"I'll show you,"
he said, and sprang to the trailer, clambering in through the hole I had smashed.
"Bakunin, no!"
I followed him inside, tumbling back into the jumble of landscapes and the maelstrom of screaming ghosts. Just for a moment, a brief moment, I saw Ayn Freuger among them. Then I was falling through another wedding, a hunting scene, a stockman's meeting, a farrier's smithy, the castle of Elmpite by moonlight, a cattle market, a... I heard Bakunin scream. I deflected three more deadly hololith plates and slashed through the thicket of howling ghosts. Spectral, as if it wasn't there, I saw the workbench and the shelves. The green bottle, glowing internally with jade fire. I raised Barbarisata and smashed the bottle with the edge of the shivering blade. The explosion shredded the inner partition wall and lurched the trailer onto its side. Dazed, I lay on the splintered wall, sprawled amongst the debris of glass and wood. The screaming stopped. Someone had called the local Arbites. They moved in through the crowds of onlookers as the last of the rain fell and the skies began to clear. I showed them my credentials and told them to keep the crowd back while I finished my work. The trailer was already burning, and Elizabeth and I threw the last few hololith prints into the flames. The pictures were fading now. Superimposed on each one, every portrait, every landscape, every miniature, was a ghost exposure. An after-image. Bakunin, screaming his last scream forever. That was Backcloth for a Crown Additional by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. The Strange Demise of Titus Endor. Written by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. The city was a hollow, failing place that was trying to turn its fortunes around, so it was apt that Titus Endor should wash up there. He'd long since lost the luster that had made him one of the Ordo's rising stars. Like a counterfeit coin, his value had been exposed as short weight. None of it had been his fault, just circumstances. Titus Endor took another drink and reflected that life could be worse. It had seemed to have been winter for 2 or 3 years. Snow fell all the time, but the city streets were so warm and busy, nothing lay for long. Slush filled the gutters, and the edges of the curbs were crusted with polished deposits of old grey ice. Tiny snowflakes freighted the air, caught in the streetlights. They drifted like random thoughts or disconnected clues. The city's name was Marisburg, or perhaps it was Chirikoburg, or Zamstad. They were all alike, the brute towns clinging to the oily edge of Karaskura's western continent. The drifting clues had dragged him from one conurbation to the next, from one drab residentiary to another, and they all blurred into one. The same streets, the same sallow faces in the streetlights, the same bars and dining halls, the same smell of wet rockcrete, the same snow. He walked alone, after hours, ate alone in eating rooms, where the other tables were stacked with chairs, made calls and asked questions, and reviewed the notes he'd scribbled in his copybooks. There were a lot of copybooks. He disliked data slates and never threw his papers away. They formed the bulk of his luggage.
He always made sure he had a spare crown or two to tip the next poor concierge confronted with the task of lugging his possessions from the street to a newly rented room. Conrad Maliko had been a professor of ethnic diversity at Sarum, specializing in taboos and stratified eating. Endor had a potted biography of him written out in one of the copybooks. In another, a green-covered book, marked 435, were the case notes of Maliko's crime, a shameless affront on Eustace Majoris involving 11 sub-adult males. Endor had almost snared Maliko in the Arctic city of Kazad, but the timing had been out, and the tip-off too vague. None of it had been his fault, just circumstances. Titus Endor had inherited a fondness for symphonic music from his first master, the late Hapshant. Hapshant had been a real character. Installed at a bar in the late evening, a glass in his hand, Endor would riff tirelessly about Hapshant. "Believe you me, a real character," he would say to his conversation partner, usually the barman, or any solitary drinker with a spare seat beside him. "Bad as a fiddle in the end," Endor always added, tapping his brow. "Worms in the head, you see." Endor remembered the days, a long time ago, when he would patiently wind up the old Vox accordion Hapshant took with him wherever he went to play some old wax disc of crackling symphonic music to help his master think. Endor had been Hapshant's pupil, Hapshant's brightest pupil. As an interrogator, he had served Hapshant right to the end of the great man's life. There had been two of them, actually. Two interrogators, Titus and his friend Gregor. Tight they'd been, best friends in service and out. Titus, though, had always been the one with a luminous future, because Gregor was too serious and charmless. They had both become inquisitors and stayed friends. Until, that is, an unfortunate business some years before, a misunderstanding that Gregor had not seen fit to overlook. None of it had been Endor's fault. Just circumstances. His fondness for the classical repertoire had come from Hapshant. Attending the performances at Marisburg's Theatricala was therefore not a drudge for Titus Endor. He would arrive at the great gilded palace, its high windows lit by 1,000 yellow globes, brush the snow off his shoulders, and take a drink in the bar before the start of the performance. The grandees would come and go, in their frock coats and silk scarves, their gowns and tiaras, and he'd watch them professionally. Sometimes his copybook would come out of his coat pocket, and he'd scribble a note or two. The auditorium was painted crimson, with scarlet upholstery and gold woodwork. When the house lights came down, it was like being seated in the ventricle of a heart, a red cavity pumping with sound. He sat in the stalls, never in the same seat. His folded program and his rented opera glasses lay in his lap. Maliko's contact had the use of a private box, to the left of the stage. Endor watched it night after night, seeing through his glasses the faint brass gleam of the inhabitants' own opera glasses in the dark balcony as they caught the stage light. He identified the box, number 435. No matter how early he rose from his seat and went to the street door, he never managed to catch the occupants of 435 leaving the Theatricala. This rankled with him, though it was never his fault, just circumstances. Liebstrom, his interrogator, had been missing for several days. Endor had sent Liebstrom to the Palace of Records in Zamstad to collate material on Maliko and his associates. The man was overdue, probably padding out his task so that he could waste time in the stews of Zamstad on expenses. Endor had thought Liebstrom a promising candidate when he'd first met him, but lately he'd begun to fancy that Liebstrom was an idler, with no appetite for the hard work the Ordo demanded. He wondered if he'd ever find himself signing the paperwork approving Liebstrom's advancement to full rosette. He doubted it. The orchestra began the overture, a great swirl of busy strings and strident horns. Zorama's Oration, one of Hapshant's favourite works. Endor settled back and glanced from time to time at the private box, noting the occasional flash and glimmer of raised opera glasses, the only hint of habitation. His head ached. The volume of the music didn't help. His head had ached a lot recently, and Endor put that down to the damnable climate he had been forced to endure in the prosecution of the Maliko case. The stage was bathed in a limed light from directional lamps. As the red curtain spurred back, The dancers came out, performing in front of a hololithic drop of mountains and coppiced woods, in which dwelt a ruined temple or two, halcyon and timeless. The woodwind section woke up with vigor, and the gauzy dancers swirled, soft and white as snowflakes. One took his attention immediately. Slender she soared, faultless in her footwork, her arms expressive and immaculate. Her hair was drawn back tightly in a bun, and her face was as implacable as a death mask, powdered white like ivory, with cheekbones that aspired to the perfection of mathematical symmetry. Endor moved his glasses away from her powerful, springing thighs and watched the private box. Light on brass. Other eyes were watching her, too. After the performance, he took himself to a bar on Zyke Street, a bright, sparkling hall of mirrors and crystal chandeliers. It was bustling with patrons from the Theatricala.
"Your pleasure, master," asked the uniformed barman.
"Grain jolic with shaved ice and a sliver of citrus," Endor requested. It had been his favourite tipple since the early days, since that place off Zansipul Street, where he and Gregor had gone to wash away the day's efforts. The Thirsty Eagle. Yes, that was it. The Thirsty Eagle. Oh, how the memories eroded. His drink arrived, served on a paper mat. The jolique was substandard and too warm. The ice had melted prematurely and left the citrus wine adrift in a disappointing flow. He drank it anyway and ordered another. His headache had eased. The room was full of loud voices and busy discussion. He thought about calling Liebstrom, but didn't want to endure the impotence of another recorded message. He ordered a third drink, and sat back on his stool to survey the room. Almost everyone was male, dressed in dapper evening wear. There was something rambunctious and fraternal about the gathering, like a coterie of men drawn together in some exclusive club. They roared at one another's jokes, and slapped one another's backs. The few women present were wives or courtesans, and acted like magnets, pulling crowds of attentive males in around them. Karaskura needs women, he had noted in his copybook. He had underlined it, and given the note 2 exclamation points. Like many colony worlds building their economies on mineral wealth, Karaskura had advertised for specialist workers, promising to pay travel costs and set up expenses in order to attract a professional labor force. Men had flooded in from all parts of the sector, drawn by the attractive salary dividends. The womenfolk of Karaskura had been eclipsed. It was reckoned that males now outnumbered females 10 to 1 in the cities of the oily coast. Endor missed female company. He'd never had any trouble in that department. In the past, his charisma, his looks, and his professional status had all combined to win him the attention of any woman that took his eye. Karaskura was like a siege. There weren't enough supplies to go around. He went back to his lodgings. Liebstrom was not there, and hadn't called. It seemed to Endor that his piles of copybooks had been disturbed and rearranged. He started to sort through them. Had someone been in his room? He woke late, bathed and shaved. He saw his reflection in the mirror. "We all grow older," he told himself. His face seemed drawn and lined, and there was a sickly pallor to it. "Too much winter light," Titus Endor told himself. His hair had been grey for a while now. He tied it back, out of convenience. There were distinguished scars on his face, the footnotes of a lifetime of battles. The biggest scar was on his leg, out of sight. Endor still wore the jagged, sour-wrapped tooth on a black cord around his neck. Gregor had dug it out of him, just after Endor had driven the beast off. Brontotaff. That had been the place. Brontotaff. How long ago now? They'd been good friends, the best. Close like brothers, until the unfortunate business some years before. A misunderstanding that Gregor had not seen fit to overlook. None of it had been Endor's fault. Just circumstances. It was sad. Endor missed his old friend. He wondered what had become of Gregor. Nothing much, he doubted. Gregor had never promised to anything. Looking in the mirror, Endor toyed with the tooth. According to the law on Brontotaff, he was damned. Even after death, a Sorapt continued to stalk its prey, so the legend went, especially a prey item that had escaped or evaded its jaws. The spirit of the Sorapt was out there, tracking him. One day it would find him at last, and strike, and balance the books.
Titus Endor laughed out loud. He saw himself laughing back at him. Plenty of ghosts stalked him, and a bestial reptilian predator was the least of them. An inquisitor had to be rational about such things. He wondered where Liebstrom was. The tooth hung around his neck like a penance. Titus Endor paid a man to let him into the Theatricala during the day. He prowled the upper galleries, looking for the door to box 435. There was no box 435. The gallery halls were dressed in red velvet carpet and scarlet wallpaper, like aortal tubes. The air smelled of stale low sticks. There was a 434 and a 436. His lingering fingers traced the soft red wall, hunting for a secret or concealed door. Liebstrom had not returned. Annoyed, his mood made worse by a nagging headache, Endor sent a damning report via courier to the Ordos. In his lodgings, a glass of Jolique in his hand, he leafed back through his copybooks, trying to build some kind of pattern. Box 435. Gonrad Maliko. The reflected flash of opera glasses in the shadows. The girl. The girl. The slender dancer. He thought about Gregor from time to time. Endor had always been the bright one, handsome, cunning, bound for glory. Gregor had been a dutiful type, a hard worker, stolid and solid. "I wonder where you are now, my old friend," Endor asked the empty room. "I was always Hapshant's favorite, and look at the career I've built. What have you ever done?" The unfortunate business still nagged at him. Endor had been put in a tough position, a damn tough position. Several of his prior cases had been placed in review. Details had been distorted and accusations trumped up, all of it so petty-minded and political. He'd had no choice in the end. When the Ordo Malleus had suggested his transfer, he'd taken it. They told him Gregor had been up to no good, and that if Endor helped to set his old friend back on straight and narrow, the case reviews would be dropped. Endor hadn't been spying, he had just been keeping an eye on his old friend. None of it had been his fault, just circumstances. He went to the next show at the Theatricala, and then to a club, and then became mixed up in a group of Navy non-coms on shore leave. He'd followed them to the next bar, an off-street den, a dance parlor. There were women there, in an abundance at odds with the global statistics, women a man could dance with. The dance was called the Zendoff, and it was as erotic as it was formal. The dance had evolved, Endor was told, because of the imbalance of men and women, a street dance of the lower classes, originally popular in bordellos. Zendoff allowed a man the opportunity of spending 5 or 10 minutes with a woman, intimately. Zendoff clubs were the most popular dives on Carascura. He took another few drinks, and then he saw her. The girl. The slender dancer. She was standing at the mirror-plated bar, smoking a low-stick and contemplating her dance card. He hadn't recognized her at first, because she was wearing a leopard-skin cloche and cape, and a gold dress, and had changed her makeup from the fierce white of the ballet. But her posture took his eye, the balance of her legs, the confidence in the set of her head, and he realized who he was looking at. He introduced himself and offered to buy her a drink. She regarded him distantly, and then asked his name. Her accent was thick. "Titus," he replied. She marked it on her card. "The fifth tune from now, Master Titus," she said, adding, "I'm a second ice." Then she walked away and took the embrace of a non-com for the next dance. He was perplexed, until he saw the way of it. Most of the women in the bar were dancers from the Theatricala. They supplemented their wages by partner dancing at the Zendoff bars, efficiently exploiting Carascura's paucity of female companionship. No wonder the clubs were popular. No wonder the clubs paid the girls well for after-hours dancing. They brought the men in, men so hungry for a 5-minute intimacy with a woman while the music played, they'd stay all night, waiting their turn, and drink well in the meantime. When his turn came, she found him at the bar.
"Master Titus,
what's your name?" he asked as he led her onto the dance floor. She seemed surprised that he should care.
"Myra," she replied.
The music began.
Endor had watched the dancers closely and had learned the steps. His mind worked that way. He took her in a close hold and turned her about the floor between other dancing couples. Glittering glow globes rotated above them, casting down a blizzard of light like snowflakes. She was close to him, taut, radiating heat. He felt how hard and sinewy her body was, how rigid. She was tiny, but all muscle. She smelled of cologne, but it did not mask the heat of her, or the residue of old ballet makeup, hastily removed, or the slight odor of sweat. She had come straight from the Theatricala, probably changing in a back room in a hurry. Sweat, hard limbs, the stale aroma of low sticks, he found it intoxicating. Pulled close to her, he noticed she had an old scar along the nape of her neck, just below the hairline. The tune ended.
"Thank you, Myra," he bowed. "Your Amasek awaits at the bar."
"My card is full. I will come over later."